From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez died last week after a two-year battle with cancer. Nicolas Maduro was sworn in as interim president on Friday. A special election will be held on April 14th. Hugo Chavez was a charismatic and controversial leader whose socialist revolution divided the country. He was an outspoken critic of the United States, while at the same time, Venezuela is the fourth largest supplier of oil to the U.S. Here to talk about Chavez's legacy and the road ahead for Venezuela are George Chicarillo Mar of Drexel University and Venezuelan journalist Francisco Toro. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Jurors have reached a verdict in the racketeering trial of former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. The verdict is to be read in about a half hour. After a months-long trial and the biggest federal probe of public corruption in decades, the case went to the jury on February 19th. International mediator Lakhdar Brahimi is briefing European Union foreign ministers today on efforts to find a political solution to the uprising and crisis in Syria that have killed an estimated 70,000 people so far. Some EU members want to send weapons to rebel forces, but as Terry Schultz reports from Brussels, European governments remain split over whether that would save lives or take them.
Brahimi is filling in EU foreign ministers on his thus far unsuccessful efforts to get negotiators from Syria's opposition and its government to start a dialogue. He's expected to meet later this week with U.S. and Russian envoys in London. Even as Britain hosts the next step in diplomacy, it's also the leading advocate of amending the EU arms embargo to allow weapons to the opposition. British Foreign Secretary William Hague says that would help push Damascus to compromise.
To send a clear message to the regime that we will do that in the absence of a political settlement.
But most EU nations say more weapons are the last thing that will help in Syria, preferring to throw more weight behind diplomatic efforts such as Brahimi's. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
North Korea reportedly has nullified the 60-year-old armistice that ended the Korean War. Jason Strother reports it has also shut down a special hotline between itself and South Korea.
These steps are in response to the U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises that began today. These key resolve drills are annual computerized war games involving thousands of American soldiers. North Korea calls these exercises a rehearsal for invasion. Last week, the UN Security Council slapped new sanctions on Pyongyang for its February nuclear test. The North Korean regime lashed out, saying it has the right to launch preemptive nuclear attacks. For NPR News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
Indian police say a man on trial for his role in a gang rape and fatal beating of a woman that caught world attention is dead. They say he committed suicide in his jail cell, but the man's family and his lawyer allege he was killed. Ram Singh was accused of driving the bus on which the rape and beating allegedly involving him and five others occurred in New Delhi. News of the December attack prompted broad outrage in India and elsewhere over India's perceived failure to protect women adequately. Cardinals are in their final day of meetings in Rome before starting their conclave to select a new pope, and the biggest annual religious event in Nepal is underway. A stream of pilgrims passes by naked ascetics puffing on cannabis pipes. The Shivaratri festival brings an estimated 1 million Hindus to an ancient Kathmandu temple each year. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. PoetryFoundation.org.
It's cloudy. We have 44 degrees on Independence Mall at 10:04. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Lynn with WHYY News. Across Philadelphia, patients often don't find out they have HIV until it's so late they already have AIDS. WHYY's Tanya English reports.
For people in the Philadelphia metro region, the rate of finding out simultaneously that they have HIV and AIDS is about 50% higher compared to the national average. People with AIDS have likely been living with HIV for many years. Activist Luke Messick says years without treatment increases the chances for immune system damage and spreading the virus to others.
One thing you have to consider is, you know, how do most people come to realize that they have HIV is through their physician.
Messick says covering more people with health insurance would boost HIV testing rates. He's a member of ACT UP Philadelphia and wants Governor Corbett to expand Pennsylvania's Medicaid program through the federal health law.
These things all prevent people from getting to the doctor when they need to.
Health advocates say they're pushing for more routine HIV testing for lots of reasons, including a hope to detect and treat infection before it progresses to AIDS. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
Philadelphia Councilman David O says he wants the city to set aside money in order to pay for the contract firefighters won in arbitration. The Nutter administration is fighting the contract in court, saying it's unaffordable. O has introduced a non-binding resolution calling for the city to pay for at least some of the contract.
The firefighters say they're $66 million. That is owed. The city says $200 million. The city says $200 million. And because it's $200 million, the city says it cannot pay it. But if there is no dispute over the $66 million, pay that immediately.
The Nutter administration contends it doesn't owe any of the money since it is still challenging the arbitration award in court. In sports, Flyers beat Buffalo. Sixers fell to the Magic. And your forecast is very nice with a high of 59 expected today under cloudy skies. Some showers tonight, a low of 50, and rain tomorrow and 55. Currently in Philadelphia, 41 degrees. It's 10:06.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Hugo Chavez's state funeral was held on Friday in Caracas, where throngs of his supporters lined the streets to say goodbye to the Venezuelan president, who died last week at the age of 58 after battling cancer. His vice president, Nicolas Maduro, was sworn in as interim president, pledging his loyalty to Chavez, and once again called his death suspicious. A special election will be held in April. Chavez was a champion of the poor, using oil revenue to improve their lives, and they were his most ardent supporters. To his critics, he was often vilified for being an autocrat, a megalomaniac, even a clown. Today in Radio Times, we get two very different opinions about this charismatic and controversial leader, Hugo Chavez, and let me introduce them to you. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is George Chicarillo Marr. He's an assistant professor of political science at Drexel University, author of a forthcoming book called We Created Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution. And George, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone is Francisco Toro. He's a Venezuelan journalist, co-author of Blogging the Revolution, Caracas Chronicles, and the Hugo Chavez Era. And Francisco, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be here.
George, let me begin with you. And we invited the two of you on because you have such different opinions about Hugo Chavez. Why do you think he's such, or was such, a polarizing figure to you, George?
Well, I would say that Chavez, of course, is polarizing for a number of reasons, although not the ones maybe that we are most familiar with in the United States, of course. When we think of Chavez, the polarizing figure, we think of Chavez in the UN, we think of Chavez calling Bush a donkey or Mr. Danger and things like this. But the reasons that Chavez is polarizing in Venezuela are very different. And actually, I like to say that it's not so much that he polarized Venezuela. This is the accusation of the opposition. It's that he revealed an existing polarization that existed between the classes, between the rich and the poor, that had been covered over for a number of decades. And what he helped to do, although it was not certainly his doing, it was the doing of the Venezuelan people, was to draw back the curtain that had been concealing this polarization for a number of decades.
And I want to pick up on that. Same question to you, Francisco.
Well, I think there's something to what George has said. There was clearly a pre-existing division in Venezuelan society that we had a problem talking about, and it was there. And Chavez was very refreshing to many people in peeling back that curtain and talking about it. I also think that at a certain point, Chavez started to understand that there was a political upside for him to exploiting that polarization, to provoking his enemies, to building up his enemies into this kind of bogeyman in order to rally support around him. And so polarization is both things. It is a pre-existing social aspect of Venezuelan society, but it's also a political strategy used cynically to rally people to the president's support.
And I want to pick up on that as well. But George, going back to you, and it seems that the support that Chavez had came from the poor people. How was their life changed when he was president of Venezuela?
Well, dramatically. I mean, that is perfectly clear. What you had in the long run-up to Chavez coming to power, and I like to bring attention away from Chavez often and bring it to the history of struggles and social movements that brought him to power. You have a number of decades in which radical social movements are struggling against a very undemocratic democracy, essentially, to put it in a way, a consolidated two-party system that very much excluded the poor, and that while buoyed by oil prices for a number of years, this eventually came to a head in the 1980s in an economic crisis, and the response by the government was a strict IMF-backed plan called El Paquetazo, a neoliberal reform plan, which dramatically decreased the quality of living of many Venezuelans. So you had a situation in which up to 60% of Venezuelans were living in poverty. There were sort of skyrocketing, you know, elements associated with that in terms of health. And what you've had under Chavez is really the first accomplishment of the Bolivarian Revolution was really a social one, making up for what was referred to as the social debt, the historical debt to the poor, by providing a much improved access to health care, to education, by dramatically decreasing poverty. There's really no argument about this.
How much? How much has poverty been decreased?
Decreased from over 50% down to 30%, and making Venezuela the most equal of Latin American countries, according to the Gini coefficient, moving from one of the most unequal to one of the most equal over a very short period of years. So this is really the social aspect of this Chavez legacy.
Francisco, can you agree with that? That poor people in Venezuela under Hugo Chavez, life did improve?
Oh, certainly. It certainly did. I think it improved quite dramatically. And I think people probably see the multiples. You see spending on education doubled, university enrollment tripled, and you see these multiples, and they're very, very impressive. There's no question about that. And the context to this, though, has to do with the political economy of a petro state. And so it's an extremely oil-dependent country. Mm-hmm. And when Chavez came to power in 1999, oil prices were at around $10 a barrel, and he left power last week with oil prices at $100 a barrel. So that multiple was 10. So my feeling is that you really have to put this in the context of other oil states. I think poverty has decreased dramatically in petro states all over the world, because when you have these huge amounts of oil profits, of windfall oil profits pouring into an economy, poverty will go down. There's no question about that.
But are you saying, is this sustainable looking forward, Francisco?
It depends on what happens with oil prices. I mean, I think it's very difficult to imagine it being sustained at the level that it was tried last year. In 2012, heading up to the presidential elections we had in October, where Chavez won with 55% of the vote, we had a situation of the state running a budget deficit that was in the same scale of Greece's, okay, at a time of very high oil prices in a petro state. So what were you doing? You were piling on debt at the same time that you were spending all of an oil windfall in order mostly to import consumption goods that could then be distributed to a population that was understandably very thankful. Now, this shows up as a huge spike in consumption statistics, which, you know, you can see that as a decrease in poverty levels. And it's true, people have a lot more stuff. They have a lot more stuff because oil happens to be very expensive. You're selling a lot of it. You're taking in over 14 years. You're taking in an average of $135 million every single day. We're pouring into state coffers. And if you spread that around, yes, you will be popular. I can guarantee that, whether your name is Ahmadinejad or Putin or Chavez. Mm. A petro state leader in these conditions will be popular.
Well, to you, George, can you have are we talking about a Bolivarian revolution using petrodollars?
Well, certainly. I mean, the fundamental starting point of this process is a demand around oil. In other words, the primary moment that drove Chavez to power was a massive rebellion in 1989 against the neoliberal reform called the Caracaso. And what sparked the Caracaso? It was a neoliberal reform package. But what political claim drove this rebellion that ended up in a state massacre in 1989 was an insult that the oil prices, the domestic gasoline prices had doubled, namely something which Venezuelans very rightly believe to be part of their inheritance, suddenly became much more expensive. And so this is, of course, the starting point of this revolution. Now, the question is one in which we need to recognize and which I think a lot of commentators neglect are the political determinants of the price of oil. This is not a windfall. The phrase windfall is very misleading. What did the Chavez regime do shortly after coming to power? They rebuilt OPEC through a concerted effort, and they drove up the oil price. This is a political strategy, and this is not something which randomly happened to the Chavez government and which could disappear tomorrow.
Let me go to you, Francisco Toro. You had a piece in The Atlantic, actually, headlined, Chavez wasn't just a zany buffoon, he was an oppressive autocrat. And one of the things that you say in this article, some of the other articles that you've written about Chavez, was that he created this propaganda state, but without creating a police state. Help us understand what you mean when you talk about the propaganda state under Hugo Chavez.
Well, again, it links back to the political economy of oil. I think most other places where you've had these kinds of radical governments over the years, you've seen governments like Cuba in the 1960s or Russia in the 1920s, which were broke. They didn't have any money. And because they were broke, well, they used repression in order to keep very radical governments in power. What's different about Chavez is that he comes to power and suddenly he has a lot of money and more money, up to $1 trillion over the 14-year period. And so this allows him to rule as a very radical leader in a different way, in a way that's not really dictatorial. And Venezuela is a country that doesn't have gulags. Venezuela is a country that has dozens of political prisoners, yes, but that's dozens. It's not hundreds or thousands. And so what Chavez was able to substitute instead of the repression that classically goes with the kind of rhetoric that he likes to use is money and propaganda. Now, if you look at the Venezuelan state broadcasting system, you see a system that has grown and grown and grown, that has an explicit policy goal to establish communicational hegemony, that has driven little by little, very gradually over 14 years, has driven dissident voices off the air, and that has taken on this tone of really a kind of religious cult, okay, where Chavez more and more, and particularly since he became critically ill, and especially since he died, he's not really treated as a political leader anymore in state broadcasting. He is treated as a kind of religious cult figure.
What do you think, George?
Well, I would first say that the entire perspective is premised on a very cynical understanding of what's going on in Venezuela, because you could take the very same phenomenon and say that Francisco is asking that a popularly mobilized revolutionary movement that it refused to build communicational hegemony. Of course it's going to try to build communicational hegemony. It's an effort to transform society. It's not, you know, this is a revolutionary movement. The goal is to convince people of a different path for the future, one very different from the past. And so, of course, the media will be used. Of course, this will be part of it. But the very concrete fact, and it doesn't take much of a genius to recognize the fact that the vast majority of Venezuelan media, especially by viewer share, remains in private hands.
Francisco, going back to you, but we are talking about a president who was popularly elected several times. Do you think that's because of this, as you say, this propaganda machine?
I think the propaganda machine is more an outcome of his popularity than a cause of it, really, although there's a feedback loop there. I mean, I want to be fair here, and I want to give Hugo Chavez his due. He was a tremendously gifted politician, an amazing communicator, and somebody who earned a kind of deep affection and respect from millions of poor Venezuelans. And I think for people on my side of the argument, people who tend to be very critical of Chavez, it's often very difficult to accept that sort of emotionally, because a lot of us hated his guts personally.
Hated his guts, you said.
I mean, hated his guts in the sense that he was very polarizing. He poked his finger in our eyes all the time, and so it became difficult for people in the opposition movement to look at the genuine affection and love that many of his poor supporters had for him and to understand that as genuine. And it is genuine. Chavez spoke to poor people with an empathy and understanding and a solidarity that poor people in Venezuela had never had directed to them before. And it changed the country. It changed our history. People loved him for it. And I think it's important to respect that while at the same time understanding that he then went on to use that very genuine love and affection that people felt for him as a basis for a propaganda state that he could build really an autocracy around. I never call it a dictatorship because it's not that, but it is an autocratic regime in which it was an autocratic regime.
I got to jump in.
Only one person made all the decisions.
I got to jump in. We are talking about the legacy of Hugo Chavez and what's ahead for Venezuela. Francisco Toro and George Chicarillo-Mar, our guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Academy of Vocal Arts, presents Don Quixote, March 2nd through 9th, in AVA's Helen Corning Warden Theater, and March 12th and 14th at Centennial Hall in Haverford. Jules Massenet's opera is a lyrical ode to the chivalrous idealist Don Quixote. Christopher Makatsouris conducts the AVA Opera Orchestra, with staging by Tito Capobianco. 215-735-1685 or avaopera.org.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
For almost four decades, Lucinda Williams has been blurring genre lines and breaking rules. But in the beginning, the music industry wasn't always so open to her iconoclastic style.
There was no Americana. There was no alternative country. There was no alternative anything. And basically, that's what they kept telling me was I fell through the cracks.
That's singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. She'll share a few stories about her life and music this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the legacy of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. He died last week after what appeared to be a two-year battle with cancer at the age of 58. As you have been hearing from both of our guests, a polarizing figure in Venezuela and in the world. And our guests are George Chicarillo-Mar. He's an assistant professor of political science at Drexel University, author of a forthcoming book called We Created Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution, and Francisco Toro, Venezuelan journalist, co-author of Blogging the Revolution, Caracas Chronicles, and the Hugo Chavez Era. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. George, it's interesting that Francisco said he and some of his others hated Hugo Chavez, hated his guts. On the other hand, on the other side, you have people that are venerating him as if he were a saint, as if nothing critical could be said of him, including the interim president. Is that also a problem for Venezuela?
Yes, although it's not, I would like to say it's probably not the problem that it's often painted out to be. What concerns me about that veneration is not that it makes me want to lump Chavez into a whole group of people with this phrase cult of personality or any of these.
Like the cult of personality,
yeah,
that kind
exactly.
of thing?
Any of these preconceived boxes that we like to put political leaders that we don't like into. What concerns me about that veneration is the dynamic that it introduces into popular movements. And so I don't, my focus is more on these revolutionary movements that drove Chavez to power. I like to see Chavez as the result of these movements. He is the mechanism thrown forth by a history of struggle. He represents these movements, and this is why the vast majority of revolutionary and popular grassroots movements always supported Chavez and do. But the question is, how does that veneration undermine the need to continue to struggle and to continue to push this government to the left? And this is a question that will become all the more acute now that Chavez is gone. And what will be the orientation of these movements toward Maduro and toward toward the government that Maduro creates? They're supporting him, of course. They're attempting to put him into power through an election. And yet, the question is what then will happen over the next 6 years?
Why do you think Maduro has raised questions about Chavez's death, seeming to allude that it was his enemies that somehow had a hand in his death? How are we supposed to understand that?
Well, I mean, I think the first step is not to put any more emphasis necessarily on that observation than on a whole number of others. I think that the press in the U.S. ran with that statement made by Maduro because it fits very well into the preconceived notions about the Venezuelan government. I mean, the reality that Maduro was pointing to, and you didn't hear this as much in the press, when Maduro mentioned the discovery of radioactive material in Yasser Arafat's body, when he mentioned other elements of this. I don't know that this is a big deal in regards to how we judge this Maduro government, and so I want to take a little emphasis off of it while refusing to cast it in a crazy light entirely.
Francisco, how do you see Maduro?
Well, I can understand why government supporters would want to de-emphasize that because it's genuinely crazy. I mean, we have to be clear about this. You cannot weaponize cancer. There's not a single reputable scientists anywhere in the world that thinks that that is anything other than paranoia. But how should we understand it? We should understand it as an attempt to place Chavez again in this mythical context of somebody who had to be a martyr. And for the revolutionary narrative, it was unacceptable for Chavez's death to be something that just happened. That they couldn't accept that. They needed Chavez's death to be meaningful, to have some kind of political meaning, and they needed to be able to blame it on their enemies. Now, you have to put this in the context of this sacralization of Chavez's figure that features so prominently in the Venezuelan public sphere now. President Maduro has now accused everybody who doesn't agree with him, because he said that the enemies, the historic enemies of the revolution, attacked the president and caused his cancer. So everybody who doesn't agree with him is now guilty of killing a saint. And you can see the way that this kind of rhetoric can be very dangerous and can very easily set the stage for violence. To me, it was a breathtakingly alarming and irresponsible thing to say.
But you are concerned that there could be some political violence in Venezuela?
I think everybody's concerned with that. Isn't George?
Well, I wanted to ask George, and he's sitting across from me here. Are you concerned about that, looking at least into the near or maybe more distant future in Venezuela?
I mean, I think in the distant future, this is always a question in Venezuela, and it's always a risk. But I do think it's a risk that's more associated with underlying dynamics within the revolutionary process. Namely, if for some reason Maduro were to lose an election in the future or this election, which he will not lose, but if he were to lose this election, I think there would be the basis for the potential for violence, precisely because people have spent 14 years moving forward, and depending on what a new government attempts to do, very few might be willing to move backward.
And it's Enrique Capriles who's at least looks like the challenger, and we should say the election will be held almost within a month of our conversation here.
Yes, on April 14th.
Francisco, let me go back to you, and you are a critic of Hugo Chavez. There's no question about it. One of the things that you wrote recently is that he leaves behind a country of state-owned steel mills that do not produce steel, state-owned electric utilities that cannot keep the lights on, and state-owned supermarkets where you may be able to find a chicken, coffee, or toilet paper, but rarely all three at the same time. Speaking, obviously, to some of the nationalization that happened in Venezuela under Chavez, are you saying that's not sustainable, or it raises a whole host of other economic questions?
Well, the tragic thing is that it sort of is sustainable because, again, oil has such a distorting effect on the rest of the economy. It wouldn't be sustainable anywhere else because you can't have an economy that is more and more state-owned and where more and more state-owned firms become basically full employment agencies for the president's supporters, although you can't work there if you're not signed up to the cult of personality. You couldn't do that in a normal economy. In Venezuela, because you have this kind of limitless supply of dollars that just kind of rain into the governments just by putting holes in the ground and pumping out black goop, it is sustainable to some extent because the Venezuelan state more and more acts, or the state-owned sector of the economy, is a cross-subsidy. It's really a racket where you take one company that makes a lot of money, and then you use the proceeds from that to paper over the cracks in, five dozen other companies that lose money.
But if there is and Venezuela is a gigantic oil creator, exporter, I mean, it seems to me that economy is sustainable, at least for some foreseeable future, Francisco.
I mean, it's sustainable, but you have to think in terms of wasted opportunities and wasted possibilities here. I mean, this is not an economy that is running well. It's an economy that's hobbling along with the continent's highest inflation, with a huge budget deficit, with shortages that are getting worse and worse. At the time that I wrote that piece, I wrote that you might be able to find chicken, coffee, or sugar, but often not all three. And it's getting more to the point where you really can't find any of those three. It's getting very difficult to find basic staples because, again, the government, even though it has this huge entry of petrodollars, you know, finds that keeping oil spending rising all the time is challenging because oil prices are high, but they're not continuously rising forever into the future. And when only one industry in the country makes profits and every other industry is taking $5 worth of lemons to make $4 worth of lemonade, you know, you do have a problem. You have a chronic problem, but you're not Zimbabwe. What I mean about sustainability is that you're not facing a Zimbabwe-like scenario where the entire economy is going to grind to a halt.
Go ahead, George. I'd be curious what you say in response to what Francisco just said.
Sure. I would say that a broad current in contemporary discourse of the opposition about the Chavez government, about the Chavista regime, is essentially praying for collapse. And it's been praying for collapse for 14 years. And so I'm glad to hear that, you know, that Francisco is admitting that there's an element of sustainability in this economy because, to be perfectly honest, this is an economy that is not running perfectly, but it's certainly running well. And it's very difficult to identify more than a handful of economies on the globe that are running perfectly. At this moment in time, we have an economy that is consistently growing, that had a very small downtick in 2009 and that has recovered from that, in which inflation is certainly higher than people would like it to be, but is well under control by historical standards, and in which there has really been an effort, and this is really where I might agree that there needs to be a lot more work done, an effort to use this oil economy to generate some kind of diversification of the economy, some kind of generation of basic and medium industry in Venezuela, because this is the challenge, the historic challenge of oil economies and resource-rich economies, is that they orient their entire economy toward, the entire economy turns toward the oil in a way that's powerfully destructive. It makes it very difficult to import anything, so that Venezuela, when Chavez came to power, was importing the vast majority of its food, despite the fact that it's a country perfectly capable of producing that food. And this is precisely because of the oil economy and the way that affects the currency.
And we're seeing that in other oil-rich countries as well, whether in Africa or the Middle East. Let me just reintroduce the two of you. Excuse me, that's George Chicarillo-Marr. He's an assistant professor of political science at Drexel University here in Philadelphia, author of a forthcoming book, We Created Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution. And joining us by telephone, Francisco Toro. He's a Venezuelan journalist, co-author of Blogging the Revolution, Caracas Chronicles, and the Hugo Chavez Era. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I want to talk about U.S. and Venezuela relations going forward, but first, let me get a couple of callers in. Looks like we have David from Wynwood. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. First, I'd like to congratulate your guest from Drexel University for continuing the tradition of American academic apology for thuggery and tyranny.
Well, you know what, David? You have called the show in the past, and you always either insult me or insult a guest. And to be perfectly honest with you, I'm going to pull you down. We have two guests on the show. They have two very different views of Venezuela. We vetted them both, and we are having a very, frankly, a very good conversation here, and I just will not let you insult a guest. Let me get Rod from Philadelphia. Rod, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. My question is Maduro articulate enough and capable enough to keep the OPEC members together and keep them convinced to maintain the price of oil, which is a tough job to maintain a cartel and get them not to sell outside of the cartel? So does he have the capability to keep OPEC together, and what does Venezuela face if he can't do that?
Well, Rod, it's a good question. And George, let me give that to you first, but Francisco, I'd like to hear from you as well. Go ahead.
Sure. I think if Maduro has has a skill that is it. You know, he was the foreign minister for many years. This was his role within the Chavez government, was to travel internationally to build alliances. He was not the head of OPEC, but he was someone who went around and attempted to mediate between different governments and to bring them to the table and to negotiate and to discuss. This is something Maduro is very good at. And so my doubt with Maduro is not so much with regard to, mm-hmm. to this international arena. The question for me is more, will Maduro be able to keep the Chavista coalition in Venezuela together, the far left and the centrists?
Francisco, your thoughts?
Well, I read pretty widely about the world oil industry and the oil markets, and I've never read anybody who is outside the sort of Chavez movement say that they believe the Chavez line about, or the Chavez propaganda line about the Venezuelan government being primarily responsible for the fact that oil prices have been very high over the last 6 years. I've read plenty of studies and plenty of opinions that highlight Chinese economic growth, that highlight demand pull, and that highlight various different, particularly demand-sided explanations for what's happened to the oil market. And so I don't really think that what Maduro does or does not say is going to do much to oil one way or another.
Rod, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. We are talking about Venezuela, the legacy of President Hugo Chavez, who died last week. And we have two guests, George Chicarillo Marr and Francisco Toro. George, let me quote something that this came from the White House. At this challenging time of President Hugo Chavez passing, the United States reaffirms its support for the Venezuelan people and its interest in developing a constructive relationship with the Venezuelan government. What do you read into that that press release or that statement from the White House?
Well, what I read into the broader statement is not necessarily that quote right there, but there is also in the statement a lot of rhetoric about democracy and about the United States' role in teaching democracy to Venezuelans is essentially what I read into it. And this is a historic element of arrogance that's built into this relationship, the idea that we have democracy here and other people elsewhere do not have that democracy. And so our job is to essentially tell people what democracy looks like and what it should look like. And now the unfortunate thing is that this is coming from a government that, especially in its previous iteration under Bush, but continuing under Obama, is a government that actually wants Chavez out regardless of whether he was elected or not. The explicit orientation of both governments has been that Chavez was a problem to be removed, whether he'd be removed by force, as was attempted with the support of the Bush government in 2002, or whether it would be done through the elections, through the continuing funding and open funding by the Obama administration of Venezuelan opposition parties. It's very difficult to say we're throwing a bunch of money at one side of the political spectrum in Venezuela and therefore we're contributing to democracy.
Right. How do you see that statement or even the U.S. relationship with Venezuela, Francisco?
Well, I mean, it's very complicated.
Yes,
there's
it is.
A huge amount of theater, okay? I mean, we should bear in mind that the same Chavez administration that spent 14 years in these histrionic, very theatrical denunciations of the U.S., using very colorful language that you sometimes felt was sort of made to go viral. They wanted these things to have this kind of multiplier effect in international public opinion. They were very successful at that. That same government would also then sell, 800,000, a million barrels of oil to the U.S. Right. Day after day after day after day. And because the Chavez government instituted a strong Venezuelan foreign aid program where they were using Venezuelan oil to donate to allies, and they were using it as a diplomatic tool, and so that oil wasn't getting paid for right away or was sold on credit or was sold at a discount, Venezuela ended up in this very strange situation where more and more the only oil that was really getting paid for in full up front was the oil sold to the United States. And so it was a deeply contradictory kind of relationship. This Chavista line that the U.S. is somehow obsessed with getting rid of Chavez, or that the U.S. needed to get rid of Chavez in order to get control of Venezuela's oil resources, is absurd, because the U.S. has control of Venezuela's oil resources. Every time one of your listeners goes up to one of those red and orange Citgo stations, they may or may not know it, but they're putting money in the pockets of the Venezuelan autocracy. And that's just the way it is.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here, but there was a coup, I guess a failed coup in 2002. Do you think, George, that if the U.S. didn't support it, do you think that the U.S. was behind it?
Well, it's not quite that simple in the sense that I think it was clear if you look at the diplomatic cables that the United States thought that the way it was about to be carried out was a bad idea, precisely because it wasn't going to work or there are a whole series of question marks involved. But the reality is the U.S. was sympathetic with the people, gave it a certain degree of support, and ultimately continued to work with and continued to fund these same people after the coup, mm-hmm. despite the fact that they'd clearly shown their anti-democratic credentials.
Well, we are going to take that very short break and then get back to our conversation. We do want to get some more callers in on the conversation. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. He died last year. He has been a colorful, controversial, and sometimes polarizing figure. We're talking with George Chicarillo Mar and Francisco Toro. And we do want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Holy Family University supports WHYY and is offering accelerated MBAs designed specifically to help adults balance school with work and life. Programs include the Holy Family MBA, the new Professionals MBA, and an MBA that blends both online and on-ground instruction. A graduate information session will be held on Wednesday, March 13th at Holy Family's Woodhaven site, 1311 Bristol Pike, Bensalem, beginning at 5 p.m. Accepting applications now for a summer start. Details at holyfamily.edu/achieve.
Scientists are creating pigs that can grow organs for human transplant, goats that produce valuable protein-rich milk, and also are altering mouse genes to trace genetic deformities.
There's a mouse that has tusks like an elephant might have.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Emily Anthes about her new book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Every day we interact with money. We earn it, save it, and spend it. But how we do these things says a lot about the value we place on money and how we feel about it, based on a myriad of personal experiences. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, our emotional relationship with money, how it began, and where we are now. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and just to recap, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez died last week after a two-year battle with cancer. Nicolas Maduro was sworn in as interim president on Friday. A special election will be held on April 14th. That's just a month away. Hugo Chavez, a charismatic and controversial leader whose socialist revolution has divided opinion leaders and divided some of his country. He was an outspoken critic of the U.S., while at the same time, Venezuela, a big oil supplier to the United States. We're talking about Chavez's legacy and the road ahead with George Chicarillo Mar of Drexel University and Venezuelan journalist Francisco Toro. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. George, I thought it was interesting, a piece in the New York Times recently that Mr. Maduro, the interim president, actually has been in the past talking with some members of the U.S. government. The indication being that maybe behind the scenes there is more contact and even contact at high levels between these two countries. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Oh, certainly. I mean, and part of what Francisco was saying in the sense that this has never been a broken relationship. This has never been a relationship that has been cut off. The oil taps were never shut off to the United States. And this relationship has been one that's been more dominated by brinkmanship in the rhetoric with the potential consequences of with regard to oil down the road on the one hand or with regard to military overthrow on the other hand. And so, you know, this is part of the relationship. There's always been this contact. But I think if the suggestion is that Maduro was in contact with the government for the potential, post-Chavez era, then I think that would be very unlikely, in part because if it were a public, any kind of public contact would look very, very bad for Mr. Maduro.
Francisco, as you look ahead, what do you hope the U.S. and Venezuela can resolve? going forward?
Well, I think, I do agree that the U.S.'s role has been counterproductive. I hope they will butt out of the Venezuelan public sphere because they haven't really helped us at all. I think the Obama administration sort of hands off, you know, make an anodyne statement that's very institutional now and then, but mostly not really push it. It's much better than what we had before, for sure.
You're saying that the Obama administration better than the Bush administration before them?
Well, sure. I mean, listen, the thing to understand is that President Bush was sort of a perfect foil for Hugo Chavez. It made it extremely easy for Chavez to garner broad international opinion, because one thing that you could get 95% of world public opinion behind was hating on George Bush. Mm-hmm. And so this was a kind of cheap way for Chavez to raise his international profile and to be seen as courageous while not really taking any risks, because he knew that U.S. public, foreign policy was overwhelmingly preoccupied with the two very ill-thought-out wars in the Middle East, and that therefore there was not really a military threat from the United States. But talking up the U.S. as a powerful ally had all kinds of political upsides for Chavez. For one thing, it could be used internally as a way of keeping dissidents under control. So many of the same social movements that George has gone to such great lengths to document, well, you should ask him, what would happen if any of the social movements on the ground in Venezuela made a strong criticism of the government because of insecurity, because the lights can't stay on, because they can't find flour to make arepas in the stores? Very quickly, some kind of Chavista official would go on the air and would denounce them as CIA agents, and that would shut them down completely. So you have to understand that the anti-American rhetoric wasn't so much about foreign policy. It was about domestic policy. It was about keeping control of people inside the country.
What do you think, George?
Well, I think Francisco is certainly onto something, but hasn't dug very deeply to sort of really grasp the root of this dynamic. Because it's true that Chavez has gone on the air himself even and denounced revolutionary collectives, especially in the more radical parts of Caracas, as being potentially infiltrated by the CIA. But what this doesn't explain is, well, why then do these radical collectives still consider, or did they still consider Chavez to be their leader? And this is really the paradox that I begin my book from, because I think it's a powerful question. And it's because these collectives recognize that there are certain things that Chavez had to say that helped him generate this image as a head of state. And yet this was certainly not going to lead them to break with this revolutionary process that they consider to be such a positive thing and such a radical transformation of their everyday existence.
But do you think the fact that he grew up poor in a rural part of Venezuela, that has informed or did inform his politics?
Oh, certainly. I mean, certainly it informed both his politics and the way in which he was able to connect with the Venezuelan people. So you have all these since Chavez's death, if you're on Facebook and with Venezuelan friends who are Chavistas, there's lots of videos going around. And there are videos of Chavez on his TV show. Also Chavez, there's a famous video of Chavez riding a bike and the bike breaks and he falls down and all these things. And he's on his television show and he's talking in a very homey way, or he'll start to sing a llanero song, a song from the Venezuelan plains. And this was how Chavez connected to the Venezuelan people, and it's not pure aesthetics. It's a real direct indication of the fact that, listen, I am one of you, and I was one of you, unlike the traditional political class.
Francisco, let me ask you about how you see Venezuela's relationship with Cuba, and even the relationship between Chavez and Castro, which had that kind of father-son psychology to it.
Well, it was extraordinary. I mean, the first thing to note about it is that it's unparalleled. There was no other true set of statesmen that I can think of in living memory that had that kind of really deep personal bond. Of course, you have to remember that Fidel Castro, while he's seen as sort of the enemy usually in U.S. public rhetoric, he's a hugely influential figure for the Latin American left. He's sort of the founder hero of this whole movement of far-left movements. And so it was always safe for Chavez to defer to him, but there seems to have been more than that. There seems to have been a very strong personal bond, and that personal bond had huge implications for Venezuela across a range of issues, because tens of thousands of Cuban doctors and Cuban sports trainers, but also Cuban spies and Cuban military security personnel and military police came into the country. We ended up in an extraordinary situation where Chavez invited Cuban military intelligence into Venezuelan barracks to keep an eye on Venezuelan officers to make sure nobody was going to rebel against them. And this is, you know, I called it in my New Republic piece a kind of reverse colonization. And I can't think of any parallel or any comparable thing anywhere else in the world. Many people believe that President Maduro is now President Maduro precisely because Fidel and Raul Castro went to great lengths to ensure that they had a pro-Cuban extremist win the fight for succession. And there were several other people who could have been it, but Maduro was closest to the Cubans. And so to many people, really the power behind the throne in Caracas for the last several years, but especially given the Maduro administration, is Havana.
Well, and George, just a quick follow-up to this. Hugo Chavez quoted as saying Venezuela has two presidents, one being himself, the other being Fidel Castro.
Yes, certainly. I mean, of course, he doesn't mean this literally, and we want to be a little careful not to get too far into crazy town when we're talking about sort of the right wing Venezuelan view of Castro. If there's anyone they hated more than Chavez, it was Castro. And yet, I think, you know, of course, this is exaggerated. I mean, Castro is the well-respected elder statesman of Latin American revolutionaries, but he is not a force for actual, you know, government transformation in the region. And so what we have instead is very much a personal relationship, very much a I mean, you described it as a father-son relationship. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Chavez described it in that way many times, and you have this very, very close, friendly relationship. I think to say that that has anything to do with Maduro coming to the presidency is simply far-fetched, in part because there's so many other reasons that it was Maduro. You know, he was one of very few very well-known central figures in the Chavez government, and he was the one who was not considered to be too much tied to the military, too much tied to the more moderate Chavistas, and at the same time not the one that was considered to be too radically to the left. And I think it's really this that explains Maduro's ascendancy at this point, rather than, say, Diosdado Cabello, who's considered to be the head of the endogenous right wing within the Chavista movement, or someone like Elias Hawa, the sort of younger and more, you know, a more popularly rooted young leftist leader.
Let me get, it looks like Daniel from Brooklyn to join us. And Daniel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'd like to thank you for the conversation.
Sure.
One question that I do have, though, is about the abuses, I guess, of the Constitution, where Maduro technically shouldn't be the interim presidency and it should be the Diosdado. So I did want to get some comments on that. And then secondly, I'd like to have your opinions on the announcement by the defense minister on full support of Maduro as presidency.
Daniel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Francisco, can I toss that to you first?
Well, it is true that under a strict reading of the Constitution, if the president-elect, the Constitution says if the president-elect is not able to be sworn in, the head of the National Assembly should be the interim president, and the head of the National Assembly is Diosdado Cabello, it's not Nicolás Maduro, and therefore that is unconstitutional. But it's a little bit like handing out a speeding ticket in the Indy 500, right? I mean, the Venezuelan Constitution has been shredded and violated every which way, including in the much more serious matter of what the caller said about the defense minister's declarations last Wednesday, essentially announcing a military regime from now on, saying that the armed forces would take it as their mission to guarantee that Nicolás Maduro was reelected in April 14, such that the people guarding the polling stations, the people in charge of security at each of the 14,000 polling stations across the country, with Kalashnikovs hung around their shoulders, are now going to be also doubling as the interim presidents get out the vote machine. And this is part of this drip of the collapse of the rule of law under Chavez in Venezuela that is continuing and accelerating under Nicolás Maduro, and of really the end of any kind of Chinese wall or any kind of separation between the armed forces as an institution that is meant to guard the republic and that is meant to be politically neutral to some extent, And then just the armed forces as really a Praetorian guard that is there to safeguard the interests of the clique in power.
How do you see it, George? I'm sure you see it very differently. And Daniel, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Oh, certainly. And I think it's important to return, and I'm glad the caller brought up this question of the interpretation of the Constitution, because it's really become a major part of what the Venezuelan opposition is sort of betting on or banking on and making a part of their efforts to delegitimize the Maduro, the Maduro presidency. The fact is, if you read the Constitution, there are different scenarios involved, and it's a question of whether or not we understand Chavez as the president to have already been inaugurated or not. And this was an interpretation that was made by the Supreme Court, which is the body that makes these interpretations. So the Supreme Court ruled that, yes, since Chavez was an incumbent, since he was not a newly elected president, Nicolas Maduro was the vice president, because if you go back a couple of months, we have, of course, the Venezuelan opposition yelling about Nicolas Maduro not even being the vice president, so they keep having to change their story, of course. And it says that the vice president, under certain circumstances, becomes the takes over the presidency. Now, what the Venezuelan opposition is saying very precisely is he takes it over as vice president and not as president, and therefore, since a vice president cannot run, then he cannot run in the election, which is crazy. Of course, you don't take over. If Obama were to die, the vice president would not take over as the governing vice president. Takes over as the president, and therefore, then runs. Mm-hmm. But the important context for this is the effort by the Venezuelan opposition to do anything they can to attempt to delegitimize this government and to do so in ways that are actually hurting them, because they're very petty, as Francisco said, handing out a speeding ticket at the Indy 500, but not for the reasons that he used that metaphor, precisely for the reasons that it makes them look very opportunistic, and them returning to power, the opposition returning to power, is going to be a political question, not a technicality.
And I do want to get back to that, but it'd be fair to say that Chavez wanted Maduro. I mean, that he not that he could handpick him, but he wanted him to be in this position.
Sure, and what he more or less could handpick was Maduro being the Chavista candidate. It's not that they could have of course gotten together and made a different decision, but it would have been very difficult given the moral the moral capital that Chavez put behind this decision. But to counter the press rhetoric, which says, now Maduro is going to take over the country. No, of course. He was chosen as a candidate. He was not chosen as a president. He's running in an election, and he will or will not be elected.
Francisco, we have about a minute and a half before we have to say goodbye, and it looks like Enrique Capriles is going to be the opposition candidate. What should we know about him?
Enrique Capriles is really the standard bearer of the most moderate wing of the opposition. This is a wing of the opposition that always wanted to participate in elections no matter how unfair conditions were, the wing of the opposition that wanted to have a social discourse, to reach out to poorer Venezuelans, to reach out in some ways to Chavez's supporters, a guy who got 6.5 million votes last year, 5 million of which were from poor people, and a guy that I've always felt is really the best that we can do. The government has always tried to paint him as a sort of CIA right-wing extremist, and it's silly and it doesn't stick because that's clearly not his ideology.
What do you think, George?
Well, I think Francisco knows that we disagree,
yes,
about our interpretation of Capriles, and both of us are really, largely speculating, because the reality is no opposition Venezuelan politician can stand up today and say, I believe in neoliberal reform or I believe in savage capitalism, because no one will do it. The reality is Chavez has, in the movements, have transformed this country to such a degree that the social reforms are not going anywhere. Every opposition leader stands up and says, I want the missions. Namely, this is the flagship of Chavista social welfare. I want the missions, but I want them better. And so this makes it very difficult for the Venezuelan opposition, on the one hand, to stake their claim to having any kind of politics different from Chavista's, on the one hand. And it also makes it very difficult to know what it is that they actually want down the road.
Well, we could go on, but we do have to end our hour. George Chikorin-Lamar, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks.
And Francisco Toro, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Francisco Toro, he's a Venezuelan journalist, co-author of Blogging the Revolution, Caracas Chronicles, and the Hugo Chavez Era. George Chikorin-Lamar, assistant professor of political science at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. And his forthcoming book is titled We Created Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can learn much more about this program. In fact, check us out on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back. We have been examining two legacies of two world leaders this morning on Radio Times. From Hugo Chavez to Pope Benedict XVI, he announced his retirement last month. We'll be talking about his legacy and what's ahead for the Catholic Church. That's coming up next here on Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Members of the College of Cardinals will meet in the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican tomorrow to begin the process of selecting a new pope. Pope Benedict XVI surprised many when he resigned last month, something that hadn't happened in 600 years. There has been speculation about who will lead the 1.2 billion members of the Roman Catholic Church. Will it be an American, someone from an African or Asian country, or someone from Europe? And even more critically, how will they address the challenges facing the church? Joining us today are William Magis, Dean of St. Joseph's University College of Arts and Sciences, Bethany Welch, Director of the Aquinas Center, and Sister Simone Campbell, Executive Director of Network. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. A jury in Detroit has convicted former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick and his father of corruption and racketeering charges. In one of the largest public corruption trials in decades, government prosecutors said Kilpatrick rigged city contracts, received bribes and kickbacks, and made personal use of a nonprofit fund. A friend, Bobby Ferguson, was also convicted on racketeering and other charges. In India, the man who police say was a ringleader of the fatal gang rape of young students in Delhi last December was found dead in his jail cell early this morning. From New Delhi, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports that authorities say an investigation is underway into the death of the defendant that India's home minister called a major lapse.
Jail authorities have said Ram Singh, who police say led them to the other five defendants, was discovered early this morning hanging from a grill in his cell, which he shared with other inmates. The spokesman for the jail said he had used an improvised rope made from bedding. Left unexplained is how he could not have awakened other inmates. Attorney V.K. Anand insisted that his client was not suicidal, but content with the direction of the trial, which is closed to the public. Prison authorities say the cause of death will be determined by an autopsy. Within hours of the news that has rocked India, the trial resumed for the four other jailed defendants. For the first time, they appeared at court without any face or head covering. Lawyers for the accused said they will petition the court for greater security. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, New Delhi.
In their latest report, UN investigators say the Syrian government reportedly is using local militia known as popular committees to commit mass killings at times sectarian in nature. Lisa Schlein in Geneva reports the committees are affiliated with Shiite Islam and the rebels are mainly Sunni Muslims.
UN investigator Paolo Pinheiro says the mass killings allegedly perpetrated by the popular committees at times have taken on dangerous sectarian overtones. He says there's an urgent need to put an end to this two-year-old unwinnable war.
The war displays all the signs of a destructive stalemate. Neither party seems able to prevail over the other militarily.
The UN investigators find all parties to the conflict fail to protect civilians. In particular, they condemn the government's indiscriminate shelling and aerial bombardment of civilian areas. They say they are alarmed at the use of medical care as a tactic of war by both the government and rebels. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
The dissident Chinese artist Ao Weiwei is coming up with a loud critique of government at society. This time, he says he is getting into music, heavy metal to be specific. He says his 81 days in secret detention in 2011, which brought international outcry, triggered his move into music. He says he'll express his opinion with his music as he does with his visual art. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Citrix with Go to My PC, enabling people to remotely access their office computer so they can work from anywhere at gotomypc.com.
It's 11:04. I'm Jennifer Lynn with WHYY News. A display of painted portraits at the Princeton University Art Museum tracks the changing ways leaders of American industry envisioned themselves over 200 years. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
The first portrait, commissioned by the New York Chamber of Commerce, was in 1772, and it was of its founder. He was a royal governor, and he's shown wearing a powdered wig, a decorative sword, and a bright red suit. Carl Cusero, a curator at the Princeton University Art Museum, says business leaders quickly divested themselves of those trappings of aristocratic privilege and instead wanted to show themselves as men of the people.
You have, for example, William H. Vanderbilt looking very much like a country parson, and yet he was one of the richest, most powerful men in the country.
Cusero assembled 50 portraits from the original collection of the New York State Chamber of Commerce into Picturing Power, Capitalism, Portraiture, and American Democracy. Cusero shows that the goals of American industry did not always sit easily with the nature of portraiture. In the late 19th century, the predominant business model in America shifted from the lone proprietary entrepreneur to the corporation, where risk is dispersed among many. The problem is the subject of a classic portrait is a single person. The Chamber of Commerce responded by cramming up to 150 portraits on every available surface over the organization's great hall.
If you think about what a portrait fundamentally does, which is offer communion with another human presence, if you lose sight of the individual, because there's so many of them crowding the individual out, it really subverts the whole purpose of portraiture.
The New York Chamber of Commerce no longer keeps its collection of portraits. The bulk of the paintings was bought by Credit Suisse, an international financial services company. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Here's the forecast. Cloudy today with some sunny breaks and a high of 59. Tonight, showers move in with a low of 50. Currently on Independence Mall in Philadelphia, 45 degrees. It's 11:06. This is WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Catholic cardinals meeting in Rome are set to go into the conclave tomorrow to select a new pope. They met all last week to discuss the qualifications the new leader will need to have to deal with some of the challenges facing the church. And according to articles in the press, there is no obvious frontrunner. American Cardinal Timothy Dolan said last week's discussions focused on church teachings, on schools, families, hospitals, support for priests, and the recruitment of more priests. He even blogged, "You may find it hard to believe since the word on the street is that all we talk about is corruption in the Vatican, sexual abuse, and money." Do these topics come up? Yes. Do they dominate? No. So today on Radio Times, we talk with some practicing Catholics about the legacy of Pope Benedict and their hopes for the future for their church. Two of them join us here in our Philadelphia studios. William Magis is Dean of St. Joseph's University College of Arts and Sciences, also a professor of theology. And Bill Magis, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us, Bethany Welch, founding director of the Aquinas Center. That's a new project on the campus of St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church in South Philadelphia, 17th and Morris Street. Street. She's a relatively recent convert to Catholicism. And Bethany Welsh, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty.
Let me begin with you, Bill, if I could. And how do you think Pope Benedict will be remembered? And I realize it depends on who's doing the remembering. But from your perspective, how will he be remembered in your mind?
I think he'll be remembered as a pope who was very strongly committed to trying to work against forces of secularism. That was part of the goal that he had in mind when he became pope. He's very concerned about what he calls not only secularism, but relativism. And so he's worked very hard in trying to emphasize how faith and reason go together in the Catholic tradition and really emphasizes the objectivity of truth, which really goes against that notion. So I think that'll be part of his legacy.
It sounds very intellectual, what you just described.
And he's a very intellectual pope. I think when people compare him to John Paul II, they see the charisma of John Paul II, and then they see, I think, Benedict as a more bookish, scholarly person who'd be very happy to stay in his study.
Oh, but obviously was a very public figure for 8 years. From your perspective, Bethany, what's his legacy to you?
I think it's very much the Charity and Truth encyclical. And I think, like Bill, it's text, it's words, it's putting into knowledge all the sort of teachings of the church, but in an attempt to make it accessible to folks like myself. But I think it's that idea that truth, love, justice are interrelated, so that there's an interconnectedness to our faith.
Which is also, I guess, sort of the basic philosophy and intellectual teachings of the church. That's how it spoke to you.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Is that why you converted to Catholicism?
I came for the headiness of it to start with. I grew up as an evangelical, probably fundamentalist, and non-denominational. So there wasn't a cogent worldview. There wasn't a history of teaching. But it really was the social justice aspect and the incredible hospitality actually from the Latino Catholic Church here in Philadelphia that ultimately convinced me that this was the most compelling faith tradition for me.
How about from your perspective, Bill, as a communicator, how do you think Pope Benedict XVI performed?
I think that in comparison to John Paul II, he didn't perform as well. So I think there have been some very public missteps. So shortly after becoming pope, there was that occasion in Regensburg, Germany, where he quoted a 14th century figure, very critical comments of Islam, which I think don't really reflect his own view and his respect for Islam. But the way that he actually conveyed the message didn't come across that well. I think the other characteristic is that it does come across as really largely intellectual. And so it speaks to a certain large segment, I think, of the Catholic population, but doesn't speak as effectively, I think, to, you might say, the kind of the typical or average Catholic.
I mean, there is PR, it seems to me, you know, in everything that a public leader does, public relations part of it.
Yes.
Do you think he resisted that or just wasn't some part of his nature?
I think it's more that it's not a part of his nature. I mean, if you just watch him in crowds, so I had the benefit of actually having an audience with him back in 2007 and watching him work the crowd much more cautious and hesitant as compared to John Paul II, whom I had visited 3 years earlier.
How about from your perspective, the PR part of being a pope?
Yeah, I would agree. I think there's that intellectual nature that doesn't necessarily lend itself to connecting with people outside the library or the study. So I think we have a great value in the writing and the teaching that Benedict brought forth, and certainly is a legacy well beyond the sort of human connection that we think of with JP2.
But there is also, and this is not the elephant in the living room, because I think we have been talking about it, as other people have, of course, the priest sex abuse scandals, questions about sort of hierarchy, Vatican hierarchy, political, I won't say shenanigans, but jockeying within the Vatican itself. Are these real issues that the Pope could have done a better job on, do you think?
They're real issues, and I think, once again, it goes back to nature. So I have the sense that Benedict really did not want to be and was not by nature a manager. And so, you know, the Catholic Church is a very huge organization. Right. And, you know, in a sense, the ideal pope matches both kind of a pastoral sense with a management and administrative sense to do both. And that was less of his calling. And so I think that was a challenge for him, just managing what was going on in the Curia.
But do you think he fell down in dealing with the sex abuse scandals?
There, I think, you know, I'd like to see more evidence. I mean, so many people have criticized him for the time when he was in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, when he should have known or did know about what was going on with regard to sex abuse, and did he act as vigorously as he ought to have? It is clear that he's made himself very available to victims of sex abuse and has actually apologized for it. For some people, that's not sufficient in light of how serious the crimes were.
And sort of questions about, if not cover-up, certainly hierarchical or administrative lack of oversight.
Yes.
And response.
Yes.
Let me get our third guest in on the conversation. Sister Simone Campbell is Executive Director of NETWRC. That's a national Catholic social justice lobby founded by Catholic sisters. Back in 2012, she was instrumental in organizing the Nuns on the Bus tour of the states opposing Congressman Ryan's budget. And her group was also cited along with the Leadership Conference of Women Religious for not focusing enough on some of the issues of abortion and same-sex marriage, focusing too much of their work and focus and attention on poverty and economic injustice. And Sister Simone Campbell, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And we've been talking with our two guests here in our Philadelphia studios, talking about the legacy of Pope Benedict XVI. And I'd be curious how you see his legacy.
Well, two things strike me. First, his courage in resigning. I think that took a huge amount of courage, for whatever reasons he did it, to go against 600 years of tradition, I think is really edifying. And the second piece is a piece that's less well known about him, but his important social teaching that challenged first world countries to be mindful of those who are left out, to say that globalization and a globalized economy takes a new sense of responsibility on the part of the first world, and that responsibility includes having economic policies that lifts up the whole world, that we're really in this together. And I think that teaching, while not well known, was a critical step forward when he said that you cannot have charity, which we like to talk about in our nation a lot. You cannot have that hand out until you have justice for all. And that was a pretty dramatic statement on his part. So while he may not be well known for it, I think historically he'll be seen as providing an important piece.
Well, in doing some reading for the show, I was also reading, Sister Simone, about some of his comments about trade unions and trade union organizers. Again, perhaps something not as well known as some of the other issues.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The fact that our Catholic social teaching says that all workers have a right to organize, and it's not just to give management trouble, but everybody should be able to use their voice to improve the working situation, the working conditions in any factory or any workplace, and that includes wages, but it also includes other factors. And he really lifted that up as being a key piece in our globalized economy.
Your group and the other group that I mentioned criticized by the Vatican for, quote, radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith. Are you reconciled to that, or are you going to carry on?
Oh, of course we're going to carry on. I mean, all we do is live the gospel. I mean, that's what we work at. And actually, those comments were more about politics than they were about faith. And so while we could have political differences, if you actually read the gospel, Jesus was forever lifting up the role of women, having women in significant leadership positions. After the resurrection, we know that Jesus appeared first to the women. So I don't know. Culture is the real source of tension at this point. It's not really faith.
But are you talking about women priests?
I would imagine that at some point that could be. The real piece for me is the struggle between a culture of monarchy with the Vatican structure that comes out of the European model of governance, which was monarchy, and what we know in our country as a culture of democracy. And Vatican II called on us, our reform program called on us to enculturate faith in each of our countries. And when we enculturate faith in a democratic culture, then we value highly the dignity of each individual, including women. And so that with valuing the dignity of each individual, we know the contributions we have to make. It's this cultural challenge right now that we're facing. And so I'm hoping that we will have a new leader who's more oriented to our pluralistic global world and may be able to see the benefits of moving in the direction of affirming everyone's dignity and everyone's contributions.
You couldn't see this, but as you were talking, Sister Simone, both of our guests were nodding quite vigorously. Let me get Bethany Welch in on the conversation. Go ahead, Bethany.
Yeah, I think I'm a post-Vatican II Catholic. Many of the millennial Catholics my age are slightly younger. I grew up in a time where the global church is the church that we know and love and are attracted to, the universal church. So I think, you know, Mass in our language, intercultural Masses, I mean, two parishes I've worked with now, you know, trilingual or four language Masses happening, you know, simultaneously where all language groups are participating, priests who speak the language of the people. And I think the relevance is what Sister Simone said, which is about our faith. I mean, I think a lot of this dialogue around the Pope and new Pope is political, it's social, it's cultural. But at the end of the day, this is about the Eucharist and about what attracts you to a way of worship and a way of living.
Well, and Bill Magis, interesting that Sister Simone used the word monarchy. And can you expand on that a bit from your perspective?
Sure. So as Sister indicated, I mean, the church really is rooted on a system that came out of the secular world. So it goes back to the Roman Empire. And so when Christianity became the official religion in the Roman Empire, it acquired both the architecture and much of the trappings of the Roman Empire. So kind of the bishop.